So on the whiteboard, it just came to me this morning what it is that I'm certainly looking for in Rilke, hoping to finding intermittently, and that is this proposition that through his artistry, Rilke points the way towards being here authentically in a way that affirms the creative power of death. Now, some people think that Rilke pushes this idea too far, that he's, you know, there's a kind of a morbid sensibility about him, that death should not be greeted or treated quite in the way that Rilke does. There have been criticisms of his position. But certainly, this is an idea that becomes very prominent in the poem, both in the middle and especially towards the end. Now, it also came to my mind that Shakespeare's sonnet number 146, which you've got on your sheets, that I handed out to you, I've already got that in front of them there, sonnet 146, a sonnet that I teach regularly in my Shakespeare courses. It's the one sonnet that is the most explicit expression of Shakespeare's religious faith, if he had a faith. There's a lot of debate about what his faith might have been. But 146 is quite unambiguous in its expression of the need to make contact with one's inner life, one's soul. And it just struck me that it provides an interesting kind of an analogy or parallel with Rilke that might be worth keeping in mind. This poem begins, "Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth." And there's this poor soul in the middle with his unhappy mouth, center of my sinful earth. And the second line is, "Feeding these rebel powers that thee array." So, you know, that the soul in here feeds all the automatic, reactive, self-indulgent parts of our life, our external life that we're all so happily involved with. But Shakespeare argues in this poem that our inner sadness, our inner lack of fulfillment, lack of completion, our inner pining is because we spend so much of our energy on those outward rebel powers. "Why dost thou pine within and suffer dearth, painting thy outward walls so costly gay?" And then in the next four lines, the next quartet, he repeats this idea in a different way. "Why so large cost, having so short a lease, dost thou upon thy fading mansion spend?" Why do we spend so much energy on that which for all of us is going to pass in such a short time? And then with typical kind of Renaissance horror, he describes, "Shall worms, inheritors of this excess, eat up thy charge? Is this thy body's end?" So it's a sonnet. A sonnet is typically made up of eight lines, which is the octave, which presents the key ideas. And then the sestet is a kind of an unpacking of that idea or a confrontation of that idea with something else. What is the something else here? If you don't want that to be like that, if you don't want your life to be eaten up by the rebel powers, then soul, live thou upon thy servant's loss. Soul, well, why don't you start living on losing, the body is the servant of the soul. So the servant's loss could provide material for the soul's gain. And let that pine, let that, the rebel powers, pine to aggravate thy store. Aggravate is such a beautiful Latin word here, because aggravate not only means to irritate, but also means to make heavy, to aggrave, to make heavy. I love telling my students that, you know, if you give up Maccas four times a week, your body's going to be aggravated by this, but maybe your soul will gain in the process. "Let that pine to aggravate thy store. By terms divine, in selling hours of dross, within be fed, without be rich no more. So shalt thou feed on death that feeds on men." So death has a different connotation in this context. Death now becomes equated with rebel powers. It becomes equated with that automatic, reactive, self-indulgent life that we lead that takes us away from the inner stillness, the the solidity of the soul. So shalt thou feed on death that feeds on men, and death once dead, there's no more dying then. Now, I like to think that Rilke's view of death in this poem is expressed in that last two sentences that just came to me. Living in the face of death, as Shakespeare wants us to do too, can be a sober annihilation of all that is false and dishonest. And you know, the great traditions, whether it's Buddhist or Gurdjieff, they all talk about the need to confront death daily. If we could have the courage and the capacity and the will to face our own annihilation, then so much of the rubbish that inhabits us would not inhabit us. And that's, I think, what Rilke is saying in the last few lines of his poem. So that's just setting up a framework for looking. Now, the other handout you've got here, the task of transformation. And that's what we've got on the screen here as well. There's a Latin quotation in the middle of this. Now, this is a wonderful document. I mean, this document is like the key that unlocks the lyrics, the elegies, the key that unlocks the elegies. He wrote this in his letter to his publisher in 1925 after he'd finished the elegies. Some of you may have seen this letter. The English translation is not so crash hot, but anyway, let's look at it. Transitoriness is everywhere plunging into a profound being. Transitoriness is everywhere plunging into a profound being. So, you know, we are all transitory and we're all transient, but where is that transience going to? Into a profound being. And therefore, all the forms of the here and now are not merely to be used in a time-limited way, but so far as we can, instated with or established within those superior significances in which we share. That sentence again. Therefore, all the forms of the here and now, not merely to be used in a time-limited way, but so far as we can, installed within, established within those superior significances in which we share. So in other words, as I understand it, all the minutiae of our life, all the forms of the here and now, our immediate existence, are not nothing, but they are part of and are to be seen as embodied within the larger reality to which we aspire. And this picks up for me Rilke's obsession with things. Everything around him is to be experienced and beheld and acknowledged and tasted. If you just look for a moment on the... where is it? The second last page of this handout. I haven't numbered the pages, sadly. The second last page, bang in the middle, there's it says question 12. And underneath question 12, there's a quotation. And this is Rilke writing to a friend of his. Everybody got it? I often wondered, you all got that?
Yeah.
I often wonder whether things unemphasized in themselves haven't exerted the most profound influence on my development and my work. The encounter with a dog, the hours I spent in Rome watching a rope maker, who in his craft repeated one of the oldest gestures in the world, as did the potter in a little village on the Nile. Standing beside his wheel was indescribably and in a most mysterious sense fruitful for me. Coming back to the sentence on the front page, therefore all the forms of the here and now are not merely to be used in a time-limited way, but so far as we can, instated, established, within those superior significances in which we share. So what he's talking about to me there is that all the minutiae of life, watching a dog, watching a rope maker, if we see these things with attention, and we embrace these things, acknowledge their being or their reality, then this is something that is part of our larger evolution. Next sentence. Not, however, in the Christian sense, from which I more and more passionately withdraw, but in a purely mundane, deeply mundane, blissfully mundane consciousness, to instate or establish what is here seen and touched within the wider, within the widest orbit, that is what is required. He's repeating himself in a way, but he's repeating, he's saying, you know, mundane is pure, is deep, is blissful. You know, we tend to dismiss the mundane, but for him, he's saying the mundane is everything of the earth. We are of the earth. And that's how he's wanting to separate himself from Christianity, which, you know, when Rilke was writing this, seemed to be so ethereal and beyond the earth in his understanding. And he continues, not within a beyond whose shadow darkens the earth. So he's having a go here at, you know, religion that sees itself as somehow superior to the earth reality. Not within a beyond whose shadow darkens the earth, but within a whole, within the whole. Nature, the things we move about among and use, are provisional and perishable. But so long as we are here, they are our possession and our friendship, sharers in our trouble and gladness, just as they have been the confidence of our ancestors. And just turn here to, where is it? I think it's the third last page, very bottom of the third last page, a little quotation after question 8. Even for our grandparents. Everybody got it? Even for our grandparents?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even for our grandparents, a house, a well, a familiar tower, their very clothes, their coat, was infinitely more intimate. Almost everything was a vessel in which they found what is human and added to the supply of what is human. So he's saying here that, you know, even for our grandparents, all the familiar aspects of their mundane environment were very much part of their intimate life, their reality. So back on the first page again. Nature, the things we move about among and use, are provisional and perishable. But so long as we are here, they are our possession and our friendship, sharers in our trouble and gladness, just as they have been the confidence of our ancestors. So he's here again affirming the importance of all the things around us. It's rather interesting because, you know, you might think these are the rebel powers, but Shakespeare's talking about all the things, the various things that are part of our life are an important aspect of our existence if we are with them and if we honour them and if we are connected with them truly. I'm sure you've all got questions about this. Next sentence. Therefore, not only must all that is here not be corrupted or degraded, but just because of that very provisionality they share with us, or temporariness could be, provisionality could be temporariness they share with us, all these appearances and things should be comprehended by us in a most fervent and understanding and transformed. Everything we live with, everything around us, all the details of our life need to be comprehended, understood, and transformed. And then he raises the question. He says, transformed? Question mark. And look on the screen up here. the task of transformation. And look what it says here. We are the bees of the invisible. We wildly collect the honey of the invisible to store it in the great golden hives of the invisible. Transformed, yes. Yes, he says, for our task is to stamp this provisional, perishing earth into ourselves so deeply, so painfully and passionately that its being may rise again invisibly in us. He's affirming here for himself his need to be present to his reality around him to such an extent that the reality around him becomes part of his being, inhabits him, and in a sense becomes invisible in him. It is our duty and our responsibility to have that kind of presence in relation to our life. And then he quotes, we are the bees of the invisible, and he has the French for this. Nous butinons, I can't translate it, I can't read it in the French, but there it is. We are the bees of the invisible. We wildly collect the honey of the invisible. Then he continues, he's talking to his publisher here. The elegies show us at this work of the continual conversion of the dear visible and tangible into the invisible vibration and agitation of our own nature, which introduces new vibration numbers into the vibration spheres of the universe. Now this is affirming, Rilke here has a cosmology which comes from alchemy, that our place on the earth, our part of the earth, is to be so sensitive to what's around us that we, in a sense, we transform the vibrations of matter into our own vibrations, and the vibrations of our matter increases the vibrations in the cosmos. That's what he says here. This work of the continual conversion of the dear visible and tangible into the invisible vibration and agitation of our own nature, which introduces new vibrations, numbers, into the vibration spheres of the universe. And then he has in parenthesis, for since the various materials in the cosmos are only the results of different rates of vibration, we are preparing in this way not only intensities of a spiritual kind, but who knows, new substances, metals, nebulae, and stars. So we, as human beings, have got a fundamental central role in the whole evolution of the cosmos. If we are present. You go?
It's like the bacteria in the gut control the whole body.
Very interesting. The bacteria in the gut control the whole body. I like it. Continuing. And this activity is peculiarly supported and hastened by the ever swifter vanishing of so much that is visible, whose place will not be supplied. Now, this is a really interesting comment, because Rilke was writing this 1920 at a time when there was this incredibly devastating sense of how America, with all its ersatz products, ersatz fruit, ersatz this, that, and the other, was taking over the world, and everything that had kind of European purity attached to it was being annihilated by Europe, by American materialism and American swank. Sorry, Carol.
That's no problem.
But that's certainly what the Europeans felt at the time, and it comes up in the poem as well. It comes up very clearly in the poem. We'll get to it. Go.
This is when the Hubble telescope was discovered.
1920s.
23.
Interesting. Very interesting. And this activity is peculiarly supported, he goes on about America here in the next section. And this activity is peculiarly supported and hastened by the ever swifter vanishing of so much that is visible, whose place will not be supplied. In other words, things that are extinguished, they're not going to be reproduced. Even for our grandparents, a house, a well, a familiar tower, their very dress, their cloak, was infinitely more intimate. Almost everything a vessel in which they found and stored humanity. Yeah, I'm just thinking here of my grandmother's place. You know, I'm thinking of the well, I'm thinking of the outdoor toilet, I'm thinking of the Köchel oven, I'm thinking of the fruit garden, and now it was all demolished, and there's apartments there. So, you know, there's that kind of, I get that what he's saying there. Now look what he says in the next sentence. Now they come crowding over from America, empty, indifferent things, pseudo things, dummy life, a house in the American understanding. Sorry?
I used to like real people.
Well, that was 100 years earlier, wasn't it? Walt Whitman was 100 years earlier, yeah. A house in the American understanding. An American apple or vine has nothing in common with the house, the fruit, the grape into which the hope and meditation of our forefathers had entered. The animated experience things that share our lives are coming to an end and cannot be replaced. So Rilke is here, you know, he's looking into the past, I suppose, but he's seeing modern technology, modern consumerism, modern advertising, modern, you know, growing fruit so that it's so plump on the outside but it's got no taste on the inside. He's seeing all this overwhelming the world. We are perhaps the last to have still known such things. On us rests the responsibility of preserving not merely their memory, that would be little and unreliable, but their human and laurel worth, laurel in the sense of household gods. The earth has no other refuge except to become invisible in us, who, through one part of our nature, have a share in the invisible, or at least share certificates, and can increase our holding in invisibility during our being here. Only in us can this intimate and enduring transformation of the visible into an invisible, no longer dependent on visibility and tangibility, be accomplished, since our own destiny is continually growing at once more actual and invisible within us. I'm just pause there for a moment. Our destiny is continually growing at once more actual and invisible within us. As I'm reading this, the whole of the ninth elegy just becomes unpacked. It's all unpacking itself there. His whole sense of what he's doing in that ninth elegy is all contained within this letter. Can we just see if we're on the same wavelength with him in this last sentence that I read out? This long last sentence. Let me read it again and let's see if we can share some thoughts on what we think Rilke is actually saying. The earth has no other refuge except to become invisible in us, who through one part of our nature have a share in the invisible, or at least share certificates, and can increase our holding in invisibility during our being here. Only in us can this intimate and enduring transformation of the visible into an invisible, no longer dependent on visibility and tangibility, be accomplished, since our own destiny is continually growing at once more actual and invisible within us. Remember that this is also written just shortly after the end of the First World War in Europe. And Rilke was writing this when he was in Switzerland. How do we get that sentence? Does anybody have total problems with it? Or does anybody have some grasp on what Rilke might be saying here? Where's my names list? Here it is.
Problem is that it's happening. People don't know what's happening.
What's happening?
This important growth.
Oh yeah, we need the microphone.
The important growth of the inner self.
Ah yes, but the thing is, Rilke seems to say, if you don't know it's happening, then it's not happening. That seems to be the big difference. Rilke seems to say we need to have consciousness of the process, otherwise nothing happens.
Well, I don't believe that.
You don't believe that?
No, I believe it's happening anyway.
Okay.
And you can't... That's the totality of a human person.
Well...
We've all got our ideas.
No, that's true. I mean, Rilke seems to be... talking about a way of being here authentically, but will this happen if we live inauthentically? Will this happen, for example, if we give our whole powers to the rebel powers? If we live without attention and presence and respect for the things around us? And or like the Americans who are turning everything into dust? That's Rilke seems to be saying that there is a way of living that is conscious and that is deliberate and that is not just automatic. That's what I think. Go.
But given Europe at the time, it seems a bit wrong. Because Europe was just as bad as everywhere else in its destruction.
Well, but Rilke is separating himself from the destructiveness of Europe. He's seeing himself aside from that. Somebody else? Microphone. There's two microphones here.
I've really got a question.
Yeah, good.
In this, he's suggesting that when we take things into ourselves authentically and consciously, that they are given a life that they wouldn't have otherwise, that they disappear.
They enlarge our life, and he talks about they enlarge the vibrations of our life, and we become more conscious and less. We become alive. In fact, it amplifies our life and therefore the life of the cosmos.
And I don't know if I haven't read the next bit, but in that elegy, he talks about us being the ones who have the sayable and therefore...
Who have the what?
The sayable.
Yeah, we have the capacity for saying.
The capacity for language.
Yep.
And to me, part of that is because we've got the... And I don't know if I'm misreading or reading things in.
Yep.
But because we have that capacity for language, we can keep things going, known, understood by that language because it's passed on through the generations and developed and
something
and
like
built
that.
On.
Yep.
So that these things have a life beyond the individual transitory life of one person.
That's
Am
possible.
I reading too much into
it? No, I think that's true. But language can be destructive or creative.
True.
You know,
when he talks about naming things,
yeah,
and therefore giving them some sense of identity,
that's right,
and understanding, that would give them a little bit less transitoriness, would it?
That's right. But he's not talking about the names per se. He's talking about what the names, how the names affect or influence the person doing the naming.
That's right. Because we give them the name to give them the identity.
That's right.
I'm only exploring.
Any other thoughts? John? It's good to be exploring. John's got a mic.
Oh, no, sorry.
When he says, whose place will not be supplied, would you comment on that? It seems to me that that's a pretty... hard word to use, pessimistic view.
So, is that in that sentence? Sorry, I'm trying.
That's on the front page.
On the front page.
Four lines from the bottom. This activity is peculiarly supported and hastened by the ever swifter vanishing of so much that is visible, whose place will not be supplied.
That for me means that, for instance, the things that had real importance, laural value of household gods that gave, you know, a sense of kind of tribal significance to our community. I mean, I'm thinking here immediately the indigenous world. If some sacred site is destroyed, then it will no longer be replaced, supplied. The destruction is almost complete. That's what I understand will not be supplied, will not be remade.
Do you agree with that?
Do I agree with it? In some sense, I do. If you look at the American Indians or the Australian Aboriginals, their territory, their world is shrinking, 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 shrinking. We're holding on to something, but eventually, will it go or not?
Well, each generation, each year, we have a new supply.
Yeah.
We have things may be lost.
Yeah.
But other things are coming up. Surely those things have to ding, are they?
Have to which, sorry?
What's the German word for the
ding, dinger, yeah.
They're a new dinger.
Yeah, that's right. I think he's obviously speaking, in a way he's speaking polemically. He's saying that, you know, things are disappearing and there is responsibility for us as human beings to be authentically in the world, to have consciousness, to have awareness. And he's obviously talking about himself as a poet as well. Now, he's got this special role, special gift, special power, which I had it, that enables him to have this deep wish to connect with a panther, a torso, a flamingo. He's just got this deep, penetrating wish to allow his words and his creativity to embrace objects. And for him, that is his life work. And he's trying to express for us, who are mere mortals, that in that direction we need to live if we wish to also have something of that immortality. Something like that.
Yeah, but you're...
Microphone's off.
You're doing that now.
I'm doing what now?
You're going... You may sell yourself short.
Yeah.
Say you're not Raina Maria Rookie, but you're going through that exercise and you have been supplied with a new earth. A new range of things, new wells, new houses, new...
Yep.
And you have to go... You are...
As best I can.
You wouldn't be here doing this course now if you weren't trying to do that, going on that same venture.
Well, I'm trying to learn something from Rilke.
Yeah, same venture. So things have been supplied, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. So it's a bit overdramatic to say his place will not be supplied.
I use the word pessimistic.
Pessimistic.
Can't put pessimism with a man like this that we're talking about, but there is a certain amount of pessimism. This is a once and for all thing that I have to do it now, once.
Well,
once,
yeah, I think that's... Well, no, he's not saying I have to do this once for all now, once. I think he's saying that each of us as human beings only have one chance. You know, we might end up as a cockroach next time round. But, you know, we only have one chance. And for God's sake, we've all only got, you know, probably 30 years left max, probably 20 max. How are we going to inhabit our lives fully, truly, creatively? What is needed? Now, you know, it's interesting here, if I can just throw a complete cat amongst the pigeons. This is Lawrence Freeman in a recent address he gave called Finding Oneself, Meditation as the Way to Self-Knowledge. Now, when I read this, I thought, well, how dramatically different is this from Rilke, or is it not? What Jesus means by losing your life means to be detached from what we can possess of ourselves. Anything that we have or are that could be possessed, status, money, identity, social identity, religious identity, all those things, the rebel powers, anything that can be seen as a possession has to be let go of. Just how radical that is in the end is clear from this teaching of Jesus. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. What will it profit if you gain the whole world and yet forfeit your soul? What can you give in exchange for yourself? Then he adds this apocalyptic phrase, reminding us of the last judgment. For the Son of Man will come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will repay each one according to what he has done. End quote. In other words, we shape our own lives. We have the ultimate responsibility for being and for finding who we are. That's not meant to be frightening. I think it's meant to be awakening. It's meant to say to us, life is serious and it is wonderful, and don't waste it, don't waste a moment of it. Now that's Rilke to me. And when I've read Thomas Merton lecturing on Rilke, it's the same thing. Don't waste it, don't waste a moment of it. I mean, Rilke can for all he likes about it, it's not Christian, it's not beyond, but there's a fundamental essential Christianity in this too. Not that I want to label it. There's an essential Buddhism in it too. So, I don't know how far we got on that. John. Microphone. Sorry. Just keep your finger on the on button.
Are you going to put it on the site, that thing that you just...
Yeah, it's on the web. It's on the web. I can do that if I remember.
Lawrence Freeman.
Really good. The whole thing is called... It's actually... I've got it on my phone. At the end of the class, if you come to me, I'll give you the exact web address, but I'll also try and remember to put it up. It's the Meditatio Talk Series 2017, which you gave in Sydney this year after the conference that we had at ACU.
Yeah, it certainly has strong echoes strongly resemble.
Absolutely. That's right. All the great priests read Rilke, even though it undermines their Christianity. Please, Margaret.
Oh, just a thought of something that once and it vanished and can't be replaced. This break was happening. World War II grave in France.
Sorry, World War II.
World War II grave in France.
Yep.
And they were going to build a wind farm over it. And then the company, actually I think it was Spaniards, did a lot of lobbying. And also the French village where this particular battle happened, and I think it was something like 2000. Australians may be killed in that village, and they decided the company,
yep,
bit of lobby, graciously pulled out, and they only have left the particular site untouched.
Good, yep.
That's one thing that hasn't vanished.
That hasn't vanished. Great, lovely. So some things are maintained if people have a strong enough voice to maintain them. Yep. Good. Carol? We're not going to get far into this poem today. I can see it. It's all right. Still got another week.
My grandparents came from Italy in the early 19th century.
Yep.
20th century. And my grandfather was a shoemaker. He left Italy with the idea of not being a shoemaker anymore.
Yep.
But he got an acre of land across from a coal mine so that in case... he could be a shoemaker, he had to be. But he wanted to have a grocery store so that he could always feed his children.
Yep.
There was a saying in my family, America fatta per te, America was made for you. And he would say that to his kids all the time. You know, and then it was said to us.
Yep.
You know, so there it was, that
yep.
whole fact.
Yep.
That there was this sense that America was like some place you go to
yeah.
give away your old crafts and
yeah.
make something new of yourself.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So are you citing that as a kind of a positive or negative example?
I'm saying that it was a fact.
It was a fact.
I mean, Rilke said it with a lot less kindness than
yeah, right.
he should have.
Yeah.
But the truth was the evolution
yeah.
of times
yeah.
was that. And I think we're headed the same.
Grandfather was actually part of that.
He was my grandparents, both of them.
I see that movement as slightly different in my understanding. I think that what Rilke is talking about here, he's not talking about the America that kind of opened up people's opportunities for, you know, grocery or whatever, or creativity. I mean, I love America. I'm passionate about American literature. I'm taking my students to New York this January. But he's talking about the way that American consumerism, as embodied, emblazoned in Times Square, for God's sake,
yeah.
is a Sodom and Gomorrah, is an adultery of human being, and how the worst sides of American culture are such an ersatz, such a, you know, Coca-Cola, Macca's, all that. That's the impulse that I think Rilke is trying to tap into, and that's become so, you know, emblazoned. Not what you're talking about.
But the truth was, in my own family, the craftsmanship
yep.
of my grandfather or my grandmother wove linen.
Yeah, right.
And she tore it up for rags because
yeah.
she said, in America, you can get better fabric than, you know, this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, all of that was so much.
Yeah.
We lost.
Yeah,
something
was lost there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Okay, let's go to the next sentence, which is halfway down. Where are we up to? Yeah, we're in the middle of the page, the big capitalized, more actual and invisible within us. So Rilke now is kind of concluding, and he's telling his publisher broadly what the elegies as a whole are about. The elegies set up this norm of existence. They're setting up, as I understand it, this way of being. Now, you know, it's interesting how many people are drawn to Rilke's elegies. You've all been drawn to Rilke's elegies. I've been drawn to Rilke's elegies. Is he just a catchword? Is it just a fancy word that sort of attracts our attention like T.S. Eliot? Or is there any real substance here? Is there a way in which Rilke is maybe a guru for us, someone who can really teach us something? Or are we going to struggle till our death's day to understand the first line of the first elegy? You know, this is the kind of meat that I need to get into for myself. I feel privileged teaching this because I'm getting further into it now myself. I've been looking at these elegies for 40-odd years. I'm still not there with them. So the elegies set up this norm of existence. They attest, they celebrate this consciousness. It's consciousness. And, you know, Rilke himself, you know, like all artists, not every word and line is perfect. You've got to kind of read the elegies and realize, well, this bit's a bit of a rubbish here, and I don't get this at all. And why is he talking about the laurel leaf like Daphne's heart? I mean, he gets sidetracked. But overall, he himself, in his poetry, is trying to track through and understand his own relationship with reality and posit ways of being. They celebrate this consciousness. Then he says, by making the mistake of applying Catholic conceptions of death, of the hereafter, and of eternity to the elegies or sonnets, one is withdrawing oneself completely from their point of departure and preparing for oneself a more and more fundamental misunderstanding. Good. I'm glad you say that, Rilke. It's important that he says that. Because death is something to be confronted and understood here and now. That's what he seems to be saying. The angel of the elegies has nothing to do with the angel of the Christian heaven. The angel of the elegies is the creature in whom the transformation of the visible into the invisible we are performing already appears complete. So the angel is something that Rilke sets up there symbolically. The angel is something there that is like a projection from Rilke's essential deep understanding, a projection of where this complete harmonization of life with reality around has been transformed. It's the image of the Christians would call it metanoia. Transformation, complete dying to oneself and being resurrected again in a form that's in harmony with something that is eternal, one would say. The angel of the elegies is the creature in whom the transformation of the visible into the invisible we are performing already appears complete. The angel of the elegies is the being who vouches for the recognition of a higher degree of reality in the invisible. Therefore, terrible to us. The opening lines of the first elegy, jeder Engel ist schrecklich. Every angel is terrible. Terrifying. Because we, its lovers and transformers, still depend on the visible. So there's a huge gap between us on this level and the level of the angels. All the worlds of the universe are plunging into the invisible as into their next deepest reality. Some stars have an immediate waxing and waning in the infinite consciousness of the angel. Others are dependent on beings that slowly and laboriously transform them, in whose terrors and raptures they attain their next invisible realization. We, let it be once more insisted, we, in the meaning of the elegies, are these transformers of the earth. Our whole existence, the flights and plunges of our love, all fit us for this task, in comparison with which there is essentially no other. Wow. Okay, nearly tea time, but 10 minutes to go. Let's turn the page and let's change the screen. Now, this is a little bit of relaxation time. A little bit. This is the Duino Elegies where that first line, Ein jeder Engel ist schrecklich, where that first line was written, and also where the opening lines of the ninth elegy were written. And this little poem is read aloud by someone who is walking along. I'm going to show you a video in a second, walking along the ridge top here around the Duino Castle. And all these trees along the side here are laurel trees, laurel leaves. So this is why the laurel leaves became so, you know, essential in his imagination in the opening lines of this poem. And this little poem is actually an early poem, around about the same time as the poem that we looked at last week, I'm circling around God like around a tower. And this poem reads, I'll read it in German and translate it. Wenn es nur einmal so ganz stille wäre, if only it could once be completely still, wenn das Zufällige und Ungefähre verstummte und das Nachbarliche Lachen, if only all that accidental and approximate, if all that only accidental and approximate thinking could just be silenced for a moment, and also all that that laughing that's going on in the neighbors. So he's searching for that complete moment of stillness. Wenn das Geräusch, dass meine Sinne machen, mich nicht so sehr verhinderte am Wachen. That all that turbulence that my emotions and senses are making in me all the time are hindering me from waking. Dann könnte ich in einem tausendfachen Gedanken bis an deinen Randen dich denken. Then, if that was so, I could, with my thoughts, with my thousandfold thoughts, I could reach to the very edge of your thinking. Und dich besitzen nur ein Lächeln lang. And I could in fact occupy you for a moment, even if only for the moment of a smile. Um dich an alles Leben zu verschenken, wie einen Dank. And in that moment, give all my thanks to you, give all my life to you in that moment with a thanks. Just share with you, if I can. I don't think I can. I can't get out of that because I'm recording on this at the moment. Oh no, I can. I'm sorry, I can't get it. Okay, let's have a little listen to this. Let's have a little listen to this and watch this journey around Duino.
Rainer Maria Rilke. Wenn es nur einmal so ganz still wäre. Wenn es nur einmal so ganz still wäre. Wenn das Zufällige und Ungefähre verstummte und das nachbarliche Lachen. Wenn das Geräusch, das meine Sinne machen, mich nicht so sehr verhindere am Wachen. Dann könnte ich in einem tausendfachen Gedanken bis an deinen Rand dich denken und dich besitzen, nur ein Lächeln lang, um dich an alles Leben zu verschenken, wie einen Dank.
Okay, let's have coffee. And that, if you want to ponder on it while we're having coffee, that is a kind of a summary of the whole of this ninth elegy, which we're moving towards. The ninth elegy opens with the question, why might we not live as Laurel? Why cannot we accept life as we find it and constantly search for other ways and choose to interfere with destiny itself? The experience of mortal life is indisputable and our place unique and necessary to the whole. We cling to life, unwilling to part with any one thing, but unsure of what, if anything, we can take with us into that other realm. The poet knows human experience would have no voice there. Here is the time of the utterable, to name and give awareness to things which we, the most transient, have created as part of our experience and have given hope that in us, in our hearts, they can be transformed and saved. Even Earth seems to carry the secret wish to be invisible in us, and in his ecstatic adoration for a brief moment, the poet takes on the angel's mantle of permanence. There it is. Coffee time. 10 minutes we've got. You've earned it. Okay, well, I hope you've refreshed yourselves now. Another assault on Rilke. So, we've all got that summary of the Ninth Elegy there. And now we're going to move on to the Ninth Elegy proper. Now, the way that I've designed the rest of the seminar today is for us to work through the Ninth Elegy. And so to have the Ninth Elegy on one lap, there it is on page 22 in your workbook. And those of you who... Does anybody not have the Stephen Mitchell translation with them that I handed out last week? You don't have it, so that's that. Anybody else not have it?
No. Wait a
minute,
I'll just double check. Sorry.
I have it. It was lost. Anybody else not have it, right? Sure. Yes, that's it. That's what it looks like. Anybody needs it, there's another copy there. No. Now, what I have done on the next sheets in this little handout, I've amplified the questions that last week, you remember, we only went over, I think, question 12 or 13, and we jumped in too deep. Most of us were drowning at the deep end of the pool before we'd learnt how to swim. So I sort of thought hard this week, from a teaching point of view, it's really interesting. I must admit, I find it's really challenging, but it's an interesting challenge to try and engage people in a very difficult poem in a translation. Because reading the German, there's a whole different kind of experience there. So my hope is that as we go through these questions, which I have amplified with texts from Rilke's letters and from other sources. Here and there I've put in things that will help us to understand what he's saying. And I'm hoping that that letter that he wrote to his Polish publisher on transformation that we've just spent the first hour on, that will hugely help to orient us into what he's doing. I really feel that it certainly has for me. So, you've all read this poem, but the first five questions, or five, eight, nine questions, are all to deal with the first two stanzas. So, let's have a look at the first two stanzas, first of all. And I'm going to read the first two stanzas in both translations, both the Stephen Mitchell translation and the translation that we've got in the workbook. So you might just like to close your eyes and try and just take this first two stanzas in, see if that helps you kind of orient yourself in this experience that Rilke is fathoming for himself and fathoming for us. Why, this is the Stephen Mitchell, why, if this interval of being can be spent serenely in the form of a laurel, now incidentally I should say here that, you know, the laurel leaf is what was given to poets in the ancient world for achieving great status as a poet, a crown of laurels. So the laurel crown has got symbolic meaning beyond just, you know, an object of nature that also has a life. For Rilke, it's got this sense of reaching a laurel, reaching the apotheosis of what it is to be a poet. Why, if this interval of being can be spent serenely, as he's walking around, Duino there, look, serenely walking around, all the laurel leaves on the rock faces. And there's the laurel leaf in the top left corner. Incidentally, this page has got the laurel leaf, it's got the blue, what kind of flower? Gentian, and it's also got the picture of Toledo by El Greco that really caught Rilke's imagination, as did Toledo itself. There's Toledo itself imposed, and there is Toledo in El Greco's version. And if you look in the top left-hand corner, you can see that I've imposed an angel in there. Just see a sort of an angel in the top left-hand corner there. In the clouds. You can't see that? I'll make it a bit
on the right hand side or the left.
Oh, there it is. Oh, ye of little faith. So, okay, here we are. Listen again. Why, if this interval of being can be spent serenely in the form of a laurel, slightly darker than all other green, with tiny waves on the edges of every leaf, like the smile of a breeze, why then have to be human? And, escaping from fate, keep longing for fate. The complexity, the ambiguity of what it is to be a human being, escaping from fate, longing for fate. Oh, not because happiness exists. You're going to be talking about happiness. Happiness, that too hasty profit snatched from approaching loss. Not out of curiosity, not as practice for the heart, which would exist in the laurel too. But because truly being here is so much, because everything here apparently needs us. This fleeting world, which in some strange way keeps calling to us. This must surely be now clearer to you after reading that opening letter as to what he's striving for. The world is kind of calling to us, and are we responding to it? Us, the most fleeting of all. Seems an absurdity, seems to be. Once for each thing. Just once, no more. And we too just once, and never again. But to have been this once, completely, even if only once, to have been at one with the earth seems beyond undoing. And so we keep pressing on, trying to achieve it, trying to hold it firmly in our simple hands, in our overcrowded gaze, in our speechless heart, trying to become it. Whom can we give it to? We would hold on to it all forever. Ah, but what can we take along into that other realm? Not the art of looking, which is learnt so slowly, and nothing that happened here, nothing. The sufferings then, and above all the heaviness and the long experience of love, just what is wholly unsayable. But later, among the stars, what good is it? They are better as they are, unsayable. For when the traveller returns from the mountain slopes into the valley, he brings not a handful of earth, unsayable to others, but instead some word he has gained, some pure word, the yellow and blue gentian. There it is. Perhaps we are here in order to say house, bridge, fountain, gate, pitcher, fruit tree, window, at most column, tower, but to say them. You must understand, to say them more intensely than the things themselves ever dreamed of existing. Isn't the secret intent of this taciturn earth, when it forces lovers together, that inside their boundless emotion all the things may shudder with joy? Threshold. This might be a thing. Threshold is a thing. But what does threshold contain in its symbolic meanings? Threshold. What it means for two lovers to be wearing down imperceptibly the ancient threshold of their door. They too, after the many who came before them and before those to come, lightly. Now let's read the other translation, same piece, same section. In your workbook on page 22. Why, if it could begin as laurel and be spent so, this space of being, a little darker than all the surrounding green, with little waves at the edge of every leaf like a breeze's smile, why then have to be human, and shunning destiny, long for destiny? Oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent loss, not out of curiosity, or to practice the heart, which could exist in the laurel, but because being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us, us, the ephemeral, that strangely concerns us. We, the most ephemeral, once for each thing, only once, once and no more, and we too once, never again, but this once to have been, though only once, to have been an earthly thing, seems irrevocable. And so we keep pushing on and trying to achieve it, trying to contain it in our simple hands, in the overflowing gaze and the speechless heart, trying to become it. Whom to give it to? We would hold on to it forever. Ah, what alas do we take into that other dimension? Not the gazing which we slowly learned here, and nothing that happened, nothing. Suffering then. Above all then, the difficulty, the long experience of love, then what is wholly unsayable. But later, among the stars, what use is it? It is better unsayable. Since the traveller does not bring a handful of earth from mountain slope to valley, unsayable to others, but only a word that was one, pure, a yellow and blue gentian. Are we here perhaps for saying house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, fruit tree, window, at most column, tower? But for saying, realise, for a saying such as the things themselves would never have profoundly said. Is not the secret intent of this discreet earth to draw lovers on so that each and every thing is delight within their feeling? Threshold. What is it for two lovers to be wearing their own threshold of the ancient door a little? They too, after the many before them and before those to come. Simple. Okay, now if you go to the creative questions to stimulate discussion on the ninth elegy. Okay. Question one. Line 7, which is the beginning of that sort of next stanza. Oh, not because happiness exists. So Rilke is here, you know, asking why, if life could begin as a laurel leaf, why do we have to be human? What are the things that drive our humanity, that drive our being? And he proposes happiness. And he discounts happiness. He says, not because happiness exists. And he talks about happiness as that overhasty profit from imminent loss. Now, you've got a quotation from his letters here. And my question to you, now, the way we're going to work this is that I'm going to give you, you know, a few minutes in pairs to discuss it separately, and then we'll open it up each time, see how that works. So we've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11. All right. So you three, that's Rose, Carol, and Margaret.
Catherine.
Rose, yep. Carol, and Catherine are a banana. So in other words, Carol, you have to move back a little bit to make a nice curve.
Okay.
So, Mari and Len, you are a pair.
As in P-E-A-R?
As in P-E-A-R. As in P-E-A-R. That's the one. Margaret and Theda, you are a pair. Heather and Mari, this Mari here, Mari Francesca. Heather and this Mari. Although we now have got another. No, well, Mari's going to have to sit in because she could. I tell you what.
I'm going to be leaving in 5 minutes.
You're going to be leaving in 5 minutes. Okay, so Mari Biddle and Mari Francesca and Heather, you form a temporary banana. A temporary banana that's going to transform into a pear in an instant. So, Mari, if you can go and sit between one Heather and another Mari, that would be great. And John and Francis, you are yet another P-E-A-R. Okay? So, here is the passage from Rilke's letter, written in 1914. This is just the beginning of the First World War. What light does this comment from Rilke's letter shed on the meaning that Rilke attaches to the word happiness? Here's the letter. Everybody got the letter in front of them? No? You don't. It's on the sheets that I handed out today that is called The Task of Transformation. Have you got that, Mari? So it's on the third page of that. It's got question one at the top of the page. You got it? And there's a quotation. Here's the quotation from Rilke. Everybody got it now? Anybody not got it, put your hand up. Okay, bananas and pears are all happy. Here we go. Listen up. This is Rilke. The reality of any joy in the world is indescribable. Only in joy does creation take place. Happiness, on the contrary, is only a promising, intelligible constellation of things already there. Joy is a marvelous increasing of what exists, a pure addition out of nothingness. How superficially must happiness engage us, after all, if it can leave us time to think and worry about how long it will last? Joy is a moment, unobligated, timeless from the beginning, not to be held, but also not to be truly lost again, since under its impact, our being is changed chemically, so to speak, and does not only, as may be the case with happiness, savor and enjoy itself in a new mixture. So go back to the poem. Why, if it could begin as laurel and be spent so, this space of being, a little darker than all the surrounding green, with little waves at the edge of every leaf, like a breeze's smile, why then have to be human, and shunning destiny, long for destiny? Oh, not because happiness exists, that over-hasty profit from imminent loss. So How does this letter shed light on how Rilke is wanting to orientate us in this poem to the purpose of our existence, to the purpose of our being? How can happiness not be included in this? We all want to be happy. Rilke is saying, be happy is not where you want to be. Why is he saying this? 2 minutes to discuss it in your fruit groups. Okay. Anyone like to share a thought or offer a thought to the group, please take a microphone in your left hand or your right hand and deliver your goods. Anyone like to share a thought? You'll start up. Mari, you've hardly been here, but you're full of thoughts. It's wonderful. You are gifted with insight and precision.
I'm sorry, this is just to start you off.
Yeah, go. So not to push for happiness, something along those lines. Yeah, good, lovely, beautiful. Any other thoughts? Any, Theda? Yeah, big loud voice, Theda.
Okay, I just felt that happiness is contrived. You plan for happiness. I go on a holiday, I'm going to be happy.
Yeah.
But joy is something you cannot plan. You can see the sun shining on a tree and you get this amazing feeling within.
Yeah.
May only last a second. But that's, to me, it's joy. Or you look at a newborn baby.
Yeah.
And you think, wow.
Yeah. Oh,
and then it's gone.
Good.
So that, to me, is the difference between the joy and happiness. And of course, with happiness, you think, well, I went on a holiday and
So that's really useful, Theda. So what your comment is helping us to understand, and Mari's comment, is that it's kind of showing us where Rilke is wanting to orientate both himself and ourselves in terms of a life that is not contrived, that is authentic, that something that's attuned to a reality that is there. So that's where we're going. Good, excellent. Let's move on to the next question. The next question says, question two, line nine, does Rilke's allusion to Ovid's metamorphosis enhance or hinder our understanding of the heart? Now, this is the line look. He says, why if it could begin and be spent so this space of being? Oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent loss, not out of curiosity or to practice the heart, which could exist in the laurel. Rose, you're on the right page, 22. No, page 22. You've got it? I'll read it again. Oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent... No, there's other people who haven't got it either. It's on page 22 of the poem.
You need a desk.
You do. But put everything down on the floor except for the two. You need two things.
What line? Nine.
Nine. One part of the banana has just left, so you are now become a pear. You've become from Cairns to Tasmania, shrunk down geographically. Okay, very good. You can cope with that. So I'm going to read this again. Everybody got the line now? Why do we cling to our humanity? Oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent loss, not out of curiosity or to practice the heart, which could exist in the laurel. Now, when you read that to begin with, well, literal meaning is, of course, a laurel is a leaf that is alive and could have a heart in theory. So what's Rilke getting at here? And the question I've asked, does this allusion to Ovid's Metamorphosis? Now, look at this paragraph from Ovid's Metamorphosis. So you can see there is an allusion here. This is Ovid's Metamorphosis. Hardly had she cried her breathless prayer. You've got this now, this page here? Hardly had she cried her breathless prayer when a numbness seized her body. Her soft breasts were sealed in bark. Her hair turned into leaves, her arms into branches. Her feet, which had been so quick, plunged into earth and rooted her to the spot. Only her shining grace was left. Apollo still loved her. He reached out his hand to touch the laurel trunk, and under the rough bark could feel her heart still throbbing. Ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. So that's the allusion. Rilke alludes here indirectly to Ovid's Metamorphosis. Remember how much he talked about transformation in that letter about the elegies. Transformation. The whole theme of these elegies is about transformation. So not because happiness exists, not out of curiosity or to practice the heart, which could exist in the laurel. Okay? Does this illusion enhance or hinder our understanding of what Rilke is getting at in terms of the heart? He's kind of building up an argument here for himself and for us about where and how the human being should be oriented in their life. Happiness is out. Curiosity is out. Practice of the heart, is that also out? Go for it, groups. Go for it, groups, bananas and pears. Incidentally, just while, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you look at the other translation from Stephen Mitchell, he says, not out of curiosity, not as practice for the heart, which would exist in the laurel too. Not as practice for the heart. So slightly different intonation there.
Thank you.
Okay. So anyone like to offer a suggestion about this question? Does this allusion to Ovid's metamorphosis enhance or hinder our understanding of the heart? Anybody got a thought on this? Francis, you've got a thought. Use your microphone. Straight into the microphone. No, not probably way off. It's probably spot on. Probably spot on.
This microphone does art, right?
Okay, that's it.
There's to me, I don't think it hinders. I think the word that I have issue with, or...
What word?
Hinder. Oh, no, practice, I'm sorry.
Practice.
Practice of the heart.
Yep. The other translation, they're both practice of the... Well, one's not as practice for the heart and the other's to practice the heart.
Yeah, no, I think Ovid's poem seems to me to say that truly in tune with all that is natural, you know, truly in tune.
Yep.
It's not a case of practicing, it's a case of just being with that.
Yep.
With the physical.
Okay, good. So, in answer to the question, does this illusion enhance or hinder an understanding?
Well, I don't think it hinders.
It doesn't hinder. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Anyone else like to add something to that? Carol, did you want to...
We were talking about that practicing life is not living life.
Yep.
He's asking us to live fully in the day, in the once and only once do you have this day, this moment.
Yep. Good. Beautiful.
Now to try to do that.
Well, it was Theda and it was Mari, Sister Mari, who in the break reminded me of two things that Thomas Merton had practiced, who was a great Rilkean. And Theda, would you like to recall?
When I was reading, I wanted to know. Can you hear me?
Go. And Sister Mari, you're next, so yes. Give the microphone to Sister Mari next.
I just felt that I didn't know that Merton had actually written something on
it. More than written, yes. Lectured.
Well, mm-hmm. I must have missed them. I thought I'd just about read it all, but obviously I haven't. But it certainly reminded me of him when he used to walk into the room, he'd say, "Hello, chair." He would name things. "Hello, table." And he actually made a point of naming things,
yep.
Which is exactly so.
Yeah, beautiful.
He was influenced.
Yeah, very good. Variety. And Sister Mari, you had another Merton memory.
Yes, when Merton sort of saw all these people and realised this incredible connection that he had with all of them, you know.
Beggars in the street you mentioned as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I think the metamorphosis, the Ovid thing goes further.
Go, tell us.
Very, very taken with the last word of the Ovid thing, could feel her heart still throbbing.
Yep.
There's an incredible metamorphosis happening quickly, and her heart's still throbbing because it's been so quick, and she still, it's fear and terror in that mind.
Yep.
Somehow.
Yep.
And I think the word practice, maybe it's not a good word somehow.
Yep.
It might be too practice, you know, working on things. Whereas the metamorphosis was a Well, different. There's a difference. There's a different feel in that extraordinary moment for the.
An experience.
I don't know.
The German is Order zur Übung des Herzens. And Übung means, literally translated, it means for the practice. It means the repetition, it means the working of.
Function?
The function of. Yeah, function might be a better word. Function. Mm. But you know, the other thing that you've just triggered in my mind, Sister Mari, is that that Ovid's Metamorphoses as a text, you know, from a literary scholar's point of view, the Metamorphoses is just such a wonderful compendium of tales of transformation. Obviously, that's what the title says, from one form into another. And I think of Kafka's Metamorphosis. And, you know, it's become such a kind of an iconic text of things changing from one form into another. And I'm thinking also of David Malouf's An Imaginary Life, which is, you know, about Ovid's Metamorphosis. And Ovid, as the poet himself in that novel, his transformation from a kind of a public poet to a spiritual being. So, you know, this is a long shot, but I think that Rilke kind of wanted to get that in there because his elegies are all about transformation. And here he's kind of linking arms with Ovid 2,000 years ago, another great poet of transformation.
See, Hopkins in the Heraclitean
Fire. I'm not hearing you.
It happens very quickly. He describes all the, you know, the flux, the change in nature, but then he moves very quickly into the sestet, into an absolute change.
Yeah.
And you get that a lot in Hopkins.
In Hopkins. Yeah. Lovely. Okay. Yes, Rose?
In the Metamorphosis story, is it a good thing she changes?
Is it a good thing? That's a good question. I can't answer it.
Is she trying to change out of fear of being abused? I don't know the story, but we have to look it up.
Yeah. Can anybody answer Rose there? Mari? The other Mari? No? Sorry.
Was it a good thing?
Was it a good thing?
I mean, was it something she wanted?
Was it something she wanted?
Does it matter?
Does it matter?
Yes, because... Oh, maybe she was good thing she was given. Did she benefit from being...
I'm thinking of the
microphones.
I'm thinking of a metamorphosis of an insect, and the insect couldn't stop that metamorphosis. And I think that's what could be similar here.
Yep.
It's going to happen.
It happened. Yep. Yep. Good.
I was thinking when Mari was talking about the difference between functionally, or what I call a function, to organic, and say it's an organic movement, so it's from within.
Yes, yes, right, good.
Rather than something that's imposed from without.
Okay, and Heather, you wanting to add something?
From within.
From within, yeah.
Sorry, I'm not sure if it's here, but I was thinking the whole idea is change is something we can't stop, and the grub doesn't want to change, but when it becomes a butterfly, it's a rather different story.
Except that for Rilke, in this poem, I'm trying to remember where that line is, Wolle die Wandlung, I think that's in the archaic Torso of Apollo. To will the change, we need to wish the change. You know, there is a sense of intentionality that change does not happen just like it does organically for us human beings. We'd be stuck in the rebel powers if it did, rather than, you know, filling the poor soul with a new life. Next question, question three. Now, reading on in this stanza, oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent loss, not out of curiosity or to practice the heart, which could exist in the laurel, but because being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us. The ephemeral, that strangely concerns us. We, the most ephemeral, once for each thing, only once. Once and no more. And we too, once, never again. But this once to have been, though only once to have been an earthly thing, seems irrevocable. So, questions 3 and 4, I'm going to bunch these two together. Can you handle two questions together? I'm sure you can. Question 3, because all that's here seems to need us, why does it seem that we are needed? First question. Second question, once for each thing only, einmal, why is once repeated 5 times? I think we've actually discussed this already in the opening sections when we were looking at the key to the elegies in Rilke's long letter. But anyway, see if you can discuss those two questions together in your fruit groups. For I'll give you 3.5 minutes this time. Fruitful. Okay. So, Catherine, would you please like to share with the group your insight about this?
She did a poem. She wrote a poem.
She wrote a poem. Let's hear the poem.
I wrote this last night because you asked us to do some homework.
Yes.
About midnight, I remember.
Yes.
I started doing it, so I don't know. But it's about sort of that idea of the reality in and then the surface on top.
Yep.
And it's about his reflections on Rome, what
yep.
he wrote
yep.
about
yep.
his experience in Rome.
Yep.
So this is a bit my experience.
Good.
Of Rome.
Okay.
Down, ever down a rough, rickety wooden stairway, lit only by a bare bulb swinging from a beam. And oh, a quick intake of breath. We are in another world. Ancient Roman residents of many rooms. Once a magistrate's home, perhaps. Once, only once, his time to strut on the stage that was once above, but now below, way below. Shattered pots, the only things left. Here, a mile below, every living thing. Above, a high, hallowed space for angels to flit and me to cling to a pew and pray. Which is me, the history lover wandering in the still dust below, or the excitement lover relishing the reality above and fearing its end? Where is my once only be?
Beautiful, beautiful, lovely. It's really great.
It really was based on the experience. I was in Rome and just wandering around a church, you know, one of the many.
Yep.
And this little monk came by and he said, would you like to go down below?
You're right.
And I said, oh yes, I would. So he brought me over to this doorway, opened it up, and there was this rickety wooden staircase going down, down, down.
Yeah,
it was almost back. I thought, gee, I hope he doesn't forget I'm down here. And I wandered around among the broken
beautiful,
blocks and
beautiful.
And then coming back up again, it was such an experience.
Beautiful.
It was so unusual.
So, Catherine, while I've got you on the hook, so to speak, would you be able to kind of take us into how maybe that poem answers either of these questions? Why does it seem that we are needed, and why is once repeated five times? Do you have a connection there for us?
Yes, I thought it means that we are the ones who enliven the universe. It only releases its secrets, so to speak, with us, a human.
Yeah.
And then the once only is the whole transitory part of the being that we know and experience, but the other being down below is not transitory.
Okay.
And the contrast is, I think, what he's trying to say.
Okay, very interesting. Now, anyone like to add to what Catherine said in terms of either of those two questions? Yes, Francis,
no,
microphone, please. You need a microphone, though, because you are adding to it. You are adding to it. How can you say you're not adding to it when you are adding to it?
I just want to ask Catherine if she'd repeat the first part of her answer. I understand the once part.
Yep.
But I just want to...
No, it's you, not the poem, but your first part of your answer.
Sorry.
Why does it seem that we are needed? Microphone, please, Catherine.
But do you mean to read the last
one? No. Explain why it seems that we're needed.
Oh, I see. I feel that we're needed because the universe is inanimate. It only releases its treasures to a human
consciousness.
Who can understand the potential within and develop it.
Okay, you disagree with that, Francis?
I don't disagree with it, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So anyone else like to share their response to either of those two questions? John, go for it.
Well, what I'd say is the words, there are two separate words, seem and apparently.
Seem and apparently. Yeah, good. Good to pick that up. He's not sure himself.
I think that the seeming and the... It has to come from the earth. It's the earth that's giving rise to this sensation of seeming to want. And it's the earth that's giving rise to this apparent call to him. It's not in his mind.
He feels a call.
It's from the earth. It's from the things.
That's very interesting.
Not
pushed by him, but it's something that's, it's the difference between...
Yeah, it's not him there thinking, oh, suddenly, seems these... The call, the seeming, the apparentness is coming from the earth.
That's right.
The ding of themselves.
But you need to be awake for that call, don't you? Otherwise you won't hear the call.
And you don't have to be... You don't want to be... it doesn't want to be a practice of the heart or curiosity.
No,
or
it can't be directed by your own ego. It has to be somehow awakened.
That's what seemed to me about the practice.
That's the important thing.
He wanted to, you've referred to his self-forgetfulness.
Yes.
I think the practice of the heart would not be an
That's right.
Self-forgetful.
It's a bit like, I do a poem with my students by Judith Wright, and the line in there is, the mountain has its own meaning. And for Judith Wright, the mountain is something that calls us with to understand, and we don't impose our meaning on it.
We might, and so I think inanimate is not quite an appropriate word, because he feels animation.
He feels animation. That's right.
It's the animation gives rise to seeming and apparent.
That's right.
Not coming out of him, not to the self-forgetful.
Good. Now, Len.
Just 20 seconds. I mean, from a science teacher's point of view.
Yep.
Basically, the scene for me is, I often say, we are the last ones to arrive on this planet. Nature has done quite well without us. And if we are the first to go, it'll continue to be the beauty that it is.
That's right.
So bringing it into consciousness, as Catherine suggests, I guess, is our gift.
That's our gift. Very good. Okay. So, I want you to... If you keep these questions, make sure you bring them back next week. We haven't quite finished yet. But the next questions, 5 and 6, lead on to a very, very interesting letter that Rilke wrote to his friend Countess Margot Cisnoris-Crewe about death. And that's where we're going to move next week. Now, in relation particularly to this diagram, Mari might leave this diagram up for us for next week, if possible. Because this whole poem is heading towards an acknowledgement and a valuing of death as an important trigger to annihilating all that is false and dishonest in our life, and to have that as a focus of our attention. I'm just reminded here of someone like John Donne, the great celebrated mystic who was, you know, like Augustine, came out of a life of turmoil and ended up Dean of St. Paul's, who had a death's head at the end of his bed to ponder on every night. There it is. That's how extreme he was. But for him, that there was that need for that recognition. But before we finish, I just want to read Heather's Rilke's Ninth Elegy. We didn't have time to photocopy this, but shall I read it, or would you like to read it, Heather? I'll read it. Okay. Rilke's Ninth Elegy. Tell him things. Show him how happy things can be, how guiltless and ours, how even the cry of grief decides on pure form, serves as a thing or dies into a thing, transient. They look to us for deliverance, we the most transient of all. Will us to change them completely in our invisible hearts into, oh, endlessly into us, whoever in the end we are. So that's a quotation which fits in very nicely to our discussion at this point. Heather then says, I have always been excited and fascinated when new things are discovered and named. New species of insects or plants, new stars or planets, new understandings of natural laws, new discoveries of the intricacy of how our bodies work or how forests work. It seems daily we discover just how tiny is our knowledge of ourselves and our planet, let alone the universe. Little by little we find out more, and our understanding grows. We name things and relate to them. There are so many millions of things that still wait, that look to us for deliverance, to be named and known and understood, and so, quote, to change them completely, endlessly into us. We can, quote, speak and be witness. Is it our language that gives them life outside themselves? We who are so privileged to exist in the age of the sayable. That's it. Beautiful. Thank you, Heather. Beautiful.
Yes.
And thank you all for another gargantuan feast. Wow.
Before we go,
I just want to... Microphone, Mari.
I just want to put these out over there for you to take. There's been a couple of adjustments. From last week I put them out, but a couple of requests for adjustments. So,
okay. Can I take some with me? Well,